Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
Even working with you from Kerry Hilson, Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school like, okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution, because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz Podcast. My guest today is music writer Jan Uhelski, who was senior editor at Queen Magazine in addition to her other accomplishments. Jan?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So there's a new documentary on Queen Magazine. Are you happy with it?
I am happy with it. I mean, I have to say I ended up with ulcers in the 3 years of making it, but the end product actually is much better than I ever imagined it would be.
Well, if you had ulcers for 3 years, that would indicate you were heavily involved in the production of the film. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I actually wasn't initially. I was the conduit between J.J. Kramer, whose father was Barry Kramer, the founder of the magazine, and Scott Crawford, who I'd worked with at Heart Magazine. And I made the introduction, and I thought that was just enough, until they kept asking me questions, and the questions were really bad. Like, uh-oh, I've got to jump in here and say, no, this is the way it was. So just in increments, they pulled me into being first a consultant, and then a co-writer, and then a co-producer. So I ended up having to wrangle most of the bands that you see in the documentary, because honestly, it was time to collect the favors. You know, it's like if I had been on the road with Kiss as many times as I have and got on stage with them, I figured they could speak in the documentary. So it was one of those things. I just got out all the trading cards and started cashing them in.
Okay. Well, you said they had bad questions, which would indicate a lack of knowledge. Do you remember any of them?
Well, I think that they wondered, like, they would ask me questions like, who is this? Like, who is Rick Siegel? Who is Dee Dee Lorraine? Are these people important? You know, the very first pillars of the people who founded Cream. So they didn't have this working knowledge of that. And I only did because I was there. You know, I mean, the sad truth about rock journalism and maybe rock bands is they eat their young. So there weren't a lot of us around to ask. So it was pretty much me and J.J. Kramer's mother, Connie Kramer, who were actually witnesses to this. So I felt like I had the sacred duty, honestly, a sacred duty, to get in there and get it right for them.
Now, you say you wrote the film. Had you had any experience in film, or was that required in this case?
It was kind of like, had I ever written before I went to Cream? No. It wasn't like writing a script. It was more like fashioning the right questions to elicit the stories that I wanted to tell, or the things that I remembered that were important. And as it went along, a narrative arc started being created by actually the interviews. It's like the first rule of journalism. Like, when you go into a story, you can't go with any preconceived notions. You have an idea of what you want, but you have to let the witnesses speak. And the better story was there. It really started to have shape when we interviewed Cameron Crowe. And he likened Cream to a band, and with three members. I mean, it actually had more members, and it was more like an ensemble cast of friends. But that was a really good hook because we could organize the three big personalities that really were the foundation of Cream. Barry Kramer, who was a pugnacious visionary who picked a fight to get what he wanted. Dave Marsh, another pugnacious visionary. And Lester Bangs, who never took anything seriously, but was a covert intellectual. So it was this really combination of these three personalities that made Cream and the various camps that collected around their viewpoints. So that, I mean, I owe Cameron a big debt for actually making it easier for us.
And of course, Barry and Lester are deceased, so that makes it even more difficult. Were there any discussions, arguments, disagreements over what the history was?
Well, I think that people think it's one way and it really wasn't. I think that there's this whole perception of when you're writing stuff that comes out of your fingers, there's not a lot of machinations and how to get the right people or how to get the right acts to cover or exactly how bombastic and how, I won't say glamorous, but how exciting it was to be in the presence of rock when it was really in its, I'm not going to say infancy, because we really were late 60s, early 70s rock, but there was this collaborative notion between the bands and the journalists and the photographers that we were all doing the same thing together and we were going to actually feed off of each other. So I thought that was important because especially in a time period where you get no access or very little access to an artist, then it was really, it was anything but that. I mean, there were times where we would take like Leslie West, the guitarist from Mountain, and we would convince him to be on our cover. But to do that, we had to cover him in White Castle hamburgers. So it was like there was all these deals struck, but it was all this sense of fun. Like we felt like we were on the same side. And honestly, the difference between the rock writers at Cream and the artists were they had better clothes. I mean, plain and simple.
So, and probably more money or access to more money.
Yeah, more money than, and, you know, all the things that went along with it. But it really, there wasn't the sense that they're in Valhalla and we weren't. It was really that we were all in the same playing field.
Well, of course, this was a heyday, as you say, sort of the second wave. We had the British Invasion, then we had album rock, and that's when Cream began. And then, of course, it was mega in the early 70s. You had access when no one had access. Did it become de rigueur to you, or were you pinching yourself all the time?
You know, I think we had this real sense of that they weren't that much different. I mean, okay, going on tour with Led Zeppelin, I was pinching myself and wishing that they weren't such assholes at times, you know? but the fact was, that was one that got me. Other than that, I had actually had a job at there was a ballroom in Detroit called the Grandy Ballroom. It was modeled on the Fillmore experiment, you know, like the Bill Graham forum. So,
and there's a documentary online about it, right?
Yeah, there is. So I was the Coca-Cola girl there for 3 years. So I actually saw everybody and I had to bring them Coca-Cola. So I saw a lot of
bands. A little bit slower. What were the duties of the Coca-Cola girl?
The biggest duty was to make sure no one spiked the Coca-Colas because it was those years of dosing, especially when the Grateful Dead would play the Grandy Ballroom. So my most important job was to keep my eye on the sodas, because what you would do is because it was such, it'd be a big night, especially in the summer, and you'd lay out all the drinks and someone would come along and try to put LSD into the drinks. And that happened so many times that was a designated role.
Okay. That begs the question, were you ever dosed?
Only once, but not at the Grandy Ballroom. There was a festival called the Goose Lake Festival. It was the same dosing that felled the Stooges. Dave Alexander, the guitar player of the Stooges, also got dosed. And when he got on stage to play with the Stooges, he forgot how to play guitar. Had I had a guitar, I would have forgotten how to play guitar. But that was the only time. No, I was really shrewd about it. When you saw your friends babbling, I mean, the whole thing about being dosed, you just think you're going insane or you have a brain aneurysm. You don't think you're dosed. You just think something's profoundly wrong. So, that just scared me.
Okay, staying on that same tip, even though alcohol really came back in the 70s, were you someone who got involved in drugs and alcohol?
No, I honestly, to be completely real, there are too many calories in alcohol. Because to quote the sainted Paul Stanley, he says, rock and roll is never kind to the fat boy. Rock and roll is less kind to the rock writer. You know, you can't look like someone's mother or grandmother or fat cousin if you're going to interview rock bands. You've got to like dress the part. And that was always part of it.
Okay. Well, that begs the question once again. Will you consider yourself at that time to be anorexic?
There were days I was a little anorexic. Yeah. You know, I've always tried to be, you know, tried to be thin, but yeah, there were times where I was definitely following the Patty Boyd diet of two saltine crackers and a slice of cheese. So yeah, I was.
And how about today?
Not today. Not just normal.
Okay. So you get a gig at the Grandy Ballroom. How old are you?
I was 15.
Okay. I grew up in Connecticut. You couldn't work legally until you were 16. What was the situation in Michigan?
False ID.
Okay.
And I mean, first of all, I went there, you had to be 17, but I had a friend who had an older sister, and that was, you could have ID that didn't have pictures on it. You can get in with your school ID. So I got into the ballroom with a false ID, and I just never told them I wasn't 17.
Okay, two questions. To get into the venue, did you have to be 17?
You
or
did.
Just to work there?
No.
Okay. So prior to getting this gig at the Grandy Ballroom, how active were you in seeing shows?
Well, the bar was adjacent to the stage, so I could always have a bird's eye view to the stage.
I guess what I'm really asking is, prior to working at the Grandy Ballroom, were you an avid concert goer?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I convinced my parents to let me go see the Stones in 1966 all by myself. So, yeah, I have always
All by yourself?
All by myself. I think about that now. Like, what the hell were they thinking and just dropping me off at an arena? I would go see bands by myself because nobody wanted to go with me.
Well, I had that same experience. I don't remember it at 10, but certainly once you hit like 14, 15, and later, you know, yeah. I would go and no one would want to go, but it wouldn't stop me.
No, me neither.
And the other thing that people say is, I have a friend who's a concert promoter in Denver. He says, well, he thinks about it throwing a party. Whereas back then they used to have seats. It was like a religious experience more than, you know, just hanging with the people.
Oh, yeah. It really was. It was like we were one, you know. It wasn't like, not to continually like conjure up the Grateful Dead, but there was that sense of community that really came out of the 60s, that we were one, we were all in it together. This was holy. And actually, there's like some kind of information that we're all sharing. It's kind of like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. We all saw mashed potatoes. We all saw mountains that are mashed potatoes. So there was just something addictive about it.
And, well, a lot of our generation sold out after Reagan lowered taxes and legitimized greed. Where did that leave you?
I had my mom years. I actually got off the road. I think I was on another Led Zeppelin tour, got off the road, found out that I was pregnant and thought, okay, you cannot be a mom and be a rock writer and be on the road. So I actually took the 80s off. My daughter was born in 80 and I came back and wrote like in the mid 80s and then came back completely in 91.
And were you married to your daughter's father?
I was, yes.
And was he in the music business?
Yes, he owned Berserkly Records.
Matthew King Coffin. You are still married to him.
Yes, I am.
That's, you know, that's very rare, not only for people of our generation, but people our age. How did you meet him?
I was working for Record World, that was the minor trade in the triad of trades. And
Cashbox, Billboard, and Record World,
exactly.
Which supposedly had the best charts. That's what they said, Record World.
They did say that for so many reasons, but we'll not explore here. And I was doing a column called The Coast, and it was Deadline. And I'd got a tip from Toby Mamus, who now works for Alice Cooper.
Yeah, I hear from Toby like every day.
I'm sure. And he told me that Journey, who had two managers, were actually splitting ways. And I just stuck it in the end of my column. No big deal. It wasn't flashy. I just, because I had an industry column. So the next week I get a call from Rogers and Cowan, and they have a client, Matthew King Kaufman, and he wants to take whoever wrote the item about the journey managers to lunch, because he had just had lunch with them and they didn't tell him that they were breaking up. So he came down to LA from Berkeley and took me to lunch, and we hit it off. He used to go to the track. I used to go to the track, and he had this contraption called a biolator. And I definitely have a metaphysical bend, and the biolator showed you your biorhythms, but also seemed like JFK had 3 critical days on the day he died. So I was fascinated. Like, I wanted to see the day I was going to die. So he left that lunch and he gave me his biolator. So fast forward, how many years later? Yeah, I'm still married.
Okay, so it was essentially an instant romance.
No, I actually had a boyfriend. So I had to work through that. You know, we were friends for about 6 months and we would go to the track. And then one day I just thought, wow, I've got something for this guy. Like, there's some chemistry. It was a slow burn.
Okay, why the track?
I had an uncle who had horses, and he taught me how to handicap as a kid. And I've always been really good at math, and I love astrology. So I always would say, oh, it's just horse astrology. If you figure out a horse's patterns, much like astrology, you figure out somebody's transits, then you can actually be pretty good at predicting who's going to win at the track. And I was. And Matt grew up across from Pimlico in Maryland, and he used to go to the track as a kid. So we both were handicappers. I mean, one of those oddball kind of associations.
So what was your biggest win ever?
Enough to buy furniture for my living room. So
wow. if we closed your betting career today, you in the black or the red?
Oh, definitely the black.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm a careful bettor, and I'm really OCD about my numbers.
Okay, so I'll ask you, is it fixed or is it not?
Even if it is, there's certain things when you look at a horse. There used to be a videotape called the Fit, I think it's Fit Racehorse by this woman called Bonnie Ledbetter, and she would show you the physicality of a horse and how you should bet at it, on it, if it has certain kind of attributes, or if it had foaming in its leg or any of those things. So even if it's fixed, which I'm certain it is, you can still override that if you look at the condition of a horse, because sometimes a horse just wants to run no matter what the jockey's thinking.
Okay, let's go back to the Grandy Ballroom. So you're the Coke girl. How long does that last?
It lasts about 3 years.
And in that 3 years, you have a desire to get deeper into the music business?
Well, I would go home after my shift, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I would write about what I'd seen. I just had a sense it was better the second time around. So I was doing these little ad hoc reviews for myself, just writing about bands. And right next to the Coke counter, there was a little kiosk. It was Barry Kramer had a head shop, and they sold like papers and sundry things, and they sold Cream magazines. I wasn't there from day one, but I used to say to them, okay, if I give you free Coca-Colas, can I write for Cream magazine? And they go, oh yeah, sure. But I kept doing that because I was bent and determined that I would write for Cream magazine, because there was no other game in town. So yeah.
It's funny because I worked in this place called the Bird Feeder, where you had food on the plaza at Snowbird in Utah. I would curry favor with the freestyle skiers by giving them big ice cream cones. So it's like the same thing. I've never actually had that experience. Okay. So you're staying up till 2 in the morning when you're in high school.
I am.
And your parents totally cool with that.
My mom was a dancer, and she used to dance with jazz bands. So she said to me when I was really young, the only thing I'm going to tell you is never date a sax player and never try heroin. So she was absolutely cool. You know, they really gave me a long leash. You know, they were kind of, Matthew, my husband, always says they're like Sid and Nancy, you know, because my parents were just like wild hipsters. So yeah, it was just normal for me.
Okay. So when did you do your homework?
I did it on Sundays, actually. Like, to this day, I hate Sundays because I had to play catch up.
Okay, so you graduate from high school. You're still working at the Grandy Ballroom.
I am.
And then where do you end up going to college?
I go to Wayne State University. And I actually, that's actually the bigger entrance to the cream, because when I was registering, a friend of mine, unbeknownst, he was going out with the art director at Cream, Charlie Oringer, and she says to me, "Well, I'm just about to break up with him. You know, I've got somebody else I have my eye on." I go, "Really? Why would you?" And she goes, "I don't know, just not my type." So I said, "Do you mind if I actually make a play for him?" It was very subtle, but that was it. I met Charlie Oringer, and that's how I got to Cream, really, is that we just started having coffee dates, and eventually brought me over to the offices. So I met everybody that way.
Okay, did you graduate from college?
Eventually, I graduated in 92 because I finally got the job full-time at Cream, and I couldn't do college in Cream. That I couldn't do that homework. So I dropped out about a year and a half into it.
And then what was the motivation and the execution of graduating?
Well, I always felt like I wanted to actually get a degree. But I think the other thing is having those 10 mom years where I was just really pretty much a housewife and learning astrology and playing the horses. I thought, I've got to figure out my next act. So I went back to school thinking I'd be a history teacher. I got a degree in history. And the only job I could get besides working for the Democratic Party was working at magazines. So I worked at BAM magazine for a while, and then I just started freelancing and then really worked my way back to my, you know, chop wood, carry water before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water after enlightenment. I just became myself again.
Okay. And where did you get your degree?
At Cal Berkeley.
Okay. So let's go back. So you meet Oringer. In the back of your mind, you want to work for Cream?
In the front of my mind, I want to work for Cream.
Okay. So this is when you're like a freshman that this starts to happen?
Yeah, I'm a freshman.
Okay. So how do you drop it on him that, hey, I want a connection to the magazine?
You know, it was just really subtle. He knew I was a writer. I mean, I was writing. I mean, for myself, I hadn't published except for, you know, a couple of things in like high school paper. But other than that, nothing. And I just talked about wanting to be a writer. So he lived at the Cream offices. Cream was a series of communes for the first like 8 years or so. So he lived where the offices were, Barry Kramer and Dave Marsh lived. So I would go over there with him and I hit it off. It wasn't so strategic. I mean, I like to be around people like me. I mean, there is that whole misfit outsider aspect of Cream magazine anyway. And there was something that connected all the people who ended up working there. And I really hit it off with Dave Marsh immediately. And Barry Kramer scared me for the longest time. But, you know, I felt like I was home.
It's funny you mention that, because that used to be a defining marker, the inside outside. And the fact that, I mean, a person who was the captain of the football team would never be the big rock fan insider. And now it's all, you know, you see people going to the Stone Show and buying $500 leather jackets. You go, they were not into the Stones back when you went in 66.
I know, right? I think about that. Like, especially, if, I don't know about you, but I've gone to my high school reunions.
I have not.
Oh, I don't recommend it, but.
Whoa, let's slow down. I'm fascinated. Which reunions have you been to? Did you start like right away, like with the 5-year reunion?
I started the 10-year. We started a 10-year, so I went to that one. Okay, I'm fascinated with history. I got my degree in history, and there's nothing like seeing your peers as a bookmark to who you were and who you become, and you measure yourself against them, which kids always do. Well, you don't really think about a 60-something doing that, but you still do that. And now it's kind of like the false memory syndrome. It's like all the people who said they were at the Sex Pistols concert, like all of the people now say they read Cream and they always, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, no.
Right, and you were at Woodstock too.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Okay, just so we get some of the geography down, what town do you grow up in?
A little town called Lathrop Village. It's outside of Detroit.
Like how far from the Renaissance Center, et cetera, whatever they're calling it?
12 miles, because Detroit's structured on mile roads. So each mile road is from downtown.
So essentially close. So if there was like a bus when you were a teenager, you could take into town.
There was a bus when I was a teenager, and that's how I had to get anywhere because I'm so dyslexic, I didn't get my license until I was 19. So yes, I took a bus to work.
And then how did you get back from the Grande Ballroom?
God made hitchhiking or asking people for rides. My girlfriends and I were like a posse of, you know, could you give us a ride in those perilous times? So yeah, we didn't have cars. None of us drove.
Right. It's not like today when the kid's 16 and they get a car. And Wayne State is how far from Detroit?
It's about 2 miles from downtown Detroit. It's an inner city college.
Okay. So when you're going to Wayne State, you're living at home?
I'm living at home.
Okay. So Barry Kramer starts Queen Magazine on top of his record store. How long after that do you start visiting the offices?
Okay. His record store was elsewhere down Cass Avenue. It was actually a place where it was an old storefront where people used to just live, turned into apartments. So Barry lived there and he turned that into his offices. So I'm there, like, it starts in March of 69 and I start going out with Charlie Oringer in August of 69. So I'm there from August 69 on.
Well, that's essentially the same because outside of Michigan, there was very little distribution of Queen Magazine
right
at that particular time. But by time you get involved, they've already gone to the structure of we're all living in a house.
No, by the time I get involved, I'm after class, I'm going to Cream and I'm working. And then Charlie would drive me back or I would just stay there. So I'm working until we don't move to the horrible hinterlands till 1972.
Okay. And so you live with your parents through this whole time?
I do. Up until I'm quasi living with Charlie, but I'm not really. Like, I wouldn't really commit. It just felt not morally wrong, just power structure wrong. So I would stay there, but I didn't really move out of my parents until maybe when we moved to Birmingham in 1973.
Okay. So it's 69. You're working at Cream. How much money are they paying you?
22. Well, if you got paid, it was 22.75, which was really 25 with the taxes taken out. Someone reminded me.
And 22.75, even in those days, was very little.
Right.
So you could essentially do what? Live with your parents, buy Cokes?
You could essentially do that. I got a job at a suburban mall, too, selling jeans. So I actually outfitted the whole staff in jeans and the Alice Cooper group if they came by, because we would, you know, I had no compunction. Like, you know, it was, I have no, this part I do still feel a little bad that I shoplifted from the store that I actually worked for, but I gave jeans away to everybody on the staff.
And how long did you have two gigs?
Oh, I had two gigs probably about 4 years.
And selling jeans, was that the only one or did you have something else you did?
No, that was the only one. I would go there in the morning, open up the store, and then I would go to Cream and I'd come back and close the store. So I pretty much was on the treadmill.
Wow. How many hours a week were you working at the store?
Oh, like, I guess probably between 20 and 30, all day Saturday, all day Sunday.
Okay, so when you get to Cream, what is the status of the magazine and the operation?
Well, when I get there, it's moving from that newsprinty thing. It actually has actual covers. It has Curtis distribution. How I really got there in the door wasn't for writing. It was because I worked at that boutique and we sold T-shirts. And I said, why don't you let me create a T-shirt line for you and I'll just sell them under the counter. I'll give you 100% of the profits. And I've got a little sister and she's got a cadre of friends. Why don't I send them door to door selling Cream T-shirts? And that's really essentially how I got my job because I created a T-shirt
okay,
business
well,
for them.
What, did the T-shirts have the famous Boy Howdy logo?
Yes, yeah.
And who created Boy Howdy?
Oh, R. Crum created it before
okay.
my time, but it was amazing. Something I think he regretted because he only got paid $50 for the logo. So,
well, he had a lot of situations. I once spent a night playing guitars with him. It was very interesting.
In wow.
73, but that's a different digression. So how many of these T-shirts do you think you sold?
Oh, I probably sold a couple, maybe 1,000.
And that's a lot.
Yeah. And then, well, it was a really popular mall store. I mean, we had like so much traffic. We really did a big business. And then my kid's sister, who's very entrepreneurial, rounded up all her friends. And I think we paid them like 20 bucks each. So then we sold them through the magazine. And then it actually got to be as big as it is. I mean, even today, people want them. So
yeah, I finally threw mine out because they were more holes than material.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, you're doing this, you're working two gigs, you're selling the t-shirts. What does that evolve into?
They give me the job as a subscription kid, which I was now fulfilling subscriptions, not a writing job. Like tapping into this entrepreneurial like kind of theme. I mean, they did that, and then I started selling small magazines to small dealers. So I handled all of that part, and then I could do reviews at night. Which I did a couple, and they were incredibly bad and terrible. And then finally I had my break when Dave Marsh took me to a press conference where Smokey Robinson was retiring and didn't tell me I had to write about it. So it was accidental on their part. For me, I always planned to write for Cream. I just didn't think it was going to take me almost 2 years to do it.
Do you think that the fact you were a woman in a boys' club worked against you?
Oh, no. It always worked for me. I think there's great power in being underestimated and getting away with really, really rude questions or really incisive ones, and people don't see it coming. I think the thing was is I think being able to write about bands or ask about bands, it was a day where they thought most women reporters were groupies, so they would really act out or not take it seriously. And I would always put that into my story. And it was funnier because of that, because I definitely have a comic bend. So I think 100% it always worked for me.
Okay. Tell the full Smokey Robinson article story, which is delineated or shown in the movie.
I went with Dave Marsh and Charlie Oringer down to a hotel in Detroit, and with a lot of hoopla, hometown hero Smokey Robinson announces that he's leaving the Miracles, a heartbreaking event for any Detroit kid, because he was like poet laureate. He was the man. And I was sad. I was a huge Miracles fan. So Dave took me because of that. But he didn't tell me. He says he did, but he didn't tell me I had to write about it. So I go back to my parents' house where I'm living, and he calls me about 9 o'clock at night, and he goes, "Where's that story?" And I go, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "You know, that story about Smokey." And I go, "There is no story." What story? So he says, you have to write it. And I go, "I don't have any Miracle albums." So he goes, "Get out over here." So by then I'm 19. I have a car. I drive to the Cream office, and I pick up his Miracles albums. I listen to him all night long and stay up all night long and write an open letter to Smokey Robinson, which was the cover story. So my first time out, it's a cover story. And it's, you know, "Please, please, please, Smokey, don't go." So,
okay. They also say in the movie it was a great letter. So the door is now open. What's your next step?
Well, next step, I'm doing reviews. I'm still working as a subscription kid, like 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day. But I'm writing reviews at night, and they're better. Like, you know, Lester's helping me. I'm writing them kind of in a style of J.R. Young he's still alive, but he was a Rolling Stone reviewer, and he always made them into little stories. So all my reviews became little stories, little vignettes. And I did that for a while. And, you know, I got all the girls' stories, you know, like I got like Dionne Warwick or Carly Simon. And one day, Lester said, "You know, this is unfair to you. We're ghettoizing you. We've got to get you out of this teenage girl ghetto." So they started giving me, like, BTO. Like, I started getting heavy metal bands as stories, you know, Led Zeppelin. So that was ha-ha funny. Let's see the girl in the short skirt write about metal bands. So, you know, I was playing against type. But that actually, I really didn't mind. Like, anything that someone else didn't want, I took because I wanted to get published.
And did you like all of this music you were reviewing and writing about?
Well, I did. I actually did. I mean, I really loved hard music. I love the MC5. I like the Stooges a lot. I actually had a great love for like Grand Funk Railroad. You know, I really did like that kind of meat and potatoes, boneheaded rock. I still do, actually.
Okay, so when is the first time you go on the road for Cream?
I think it was 1972. I go on the road with Steve Miller, and we go to a couple of dates in Ohio.
Who's paying for that?
Well, I think it was Capitol Records at the time. That was when they would, you know, people would foot the bill for everything. You know, the days of like showering you with ephemera and lobster dinners.
And was there a wink, wink, this can't be a negative article?
No, it wasn't at all, actually. He was a really good teacher for a lot of things. If that was the first one, it was really good. Like, he had a brother who was a heroin addict, and he told me all about it. And when I didn't put it in the story, I saw him later. He goes, "Well, I gave you an exclusive. Why didn't you use it?" I think I didn't know that you could be that brutal at the time. I mean, I was just finding my sea legs. So, no, he was good. He also... I remember him making a pass at me, and I'm saying, "Oh no, I have a boyfriend." And he said, "Well, that was just a test." And I said, "Oh yeah, right." And he goes, "No, how could you actually sleep with somebody that you were doing a story on and think that you could stick a microphone in their face the next day and actually get something?" So, I mean, that was a good cautionary tale anyway. So I thank him for a lot.
And was your style to use a cassette recorder?
Yeah. I took notes and a cassette recorder. Actually, I'm such a spoon bender. I've always had two tape recorders with me at all times.
What kind of tape recorders were they?
A little Sony cassette. I still own them today, okay? They're relics.
Okay, so let's say you went on the road with Steve Miller, how many cassettes would you end up with?
Oh, my God. Well, I would just, because I overdo things anyway, I would take six of them. Just keep them talking, because you really don't know what's a good quote. I think when you're learning how to do journalism, you don't know what's important. So you just record everything and you know, the story emerges, but, you know, what if you miss it? So I think the worst part about journalism was always transcribing the tapes.
Okay, so if you're on the road with Steve Miller, there's obviously a sit down at some point, but there must be interaction in between. And you're not recording that, are you?
No, you're taking notes on that. Like we were in Cleveland, they went to his cousin's house for dinner. You know, so there's all those cute little moments and you learn to use those because everything's a metaphor and every object you see and every reaction that someone has to something that's not mostly a rock question, like a quiz show question, is where the really more important stuff is. It's like when you see the nature of the person who makes the music, then it somehow informs the music in a much more interesting way. So I've really been more of a forensic object reporter where I'll talk about somebody in terms of their objects or how they act or how they, at one point once how a man treated a Jesse Mail and how he treated a waitress, you know, because it, everything is everything, as they quaintly used to say in the 70s.
Right. So if you're on the road with Steve Miller, are you the only writer on the road with Steve Miller at that time?
Yeah.
Okay. The magazine came out monthly.
Right.
And needless to say, life goes by daily. So there were certain times where you would write or do something, and by the time the magazine is produced, your stuff is not included?
Your stuff is included. You know,
no, I mean, would you ever write something that ended up on the cutting room floor?
Never, actually.
Never?
Never.
And to what degree would the editors alter what you wrote?
Not much. I mean, you know, we were all pretty like I read some of that stuff. Like, I'm compiling a anniversary issue to go out with the documentary, and I'm like going, oh my god, really, we wrote that? It's not just me. It's like, so I look at some of my stuff and I cringe, but I look at other stuff and go, wow, I was pretty fearless. I can't believe I wrote that. But no, I think the thing was, it was such a collaborative, great working environment, like a think tank, that if we needed help, we would talk to the person next to us. We're really small and we're all really close and insular. So if I was having trouble on a story, I'd go to Marsh or I'd go to Lester or Ben Edmonds and say, hey, could you help me on this? So no, it was never.
Okay, so you break in with Steve. Who's your next big act?
Oh, Rick Wakeman's my next big act.
Rick Wakeman, so he's already left, yes?
He's doing
the Cape stuff and all that other stuff?
Yep, he is.
Not really a typical Cream Magazine article, so tell us that story.
Well, because the thing was, we would always like to put somebody in the situation and we would choose for personalities. Like, he was a great raconteur. He was just funny as hell. And I did this one actually with Cameron Crowe. And I remember we, three of us had went down to have lunch, and it was just like a boozy lunch and it was super funny. I recorded that, used none of that. And then later I went to his room. And I remember this so vividly because it was one of those, oh my God, rite of passage things. He answers the door in a towel and I go, all right, what? And I tell him to put some clothes on and he won't, just to fuck with me, right? Not to make a move, but just to actually leverage the power of the interview. And it was, this is what you would put in if you were a more seasoned journalist. I don't think I even put in that he wouldn't put clothes on, which is really ridiculously stupid of me. You know, in hindsight, what I left out was more interesting than I put in at that point.
And by your own choice, did you ever have boyfriends in this world, whether they be stars or other business people?
Well,
or were you loyal to Charlie?
No, I was like monogamous. And the other part was, is who had time to meet people? Because we were such a small staff, we really didn't do anything but go to the office. Like, we worked maybe 18 hours a day. And when we went out, we tended to go out en masse. Like, we would go see a band together. Like, everybody would go. And we socialized together. There was really very little life outside of Cream. You know, I was really monogamous.
And, okay, Rick Wakeman. Ultimately, you work with Led Zeppelin and Lynyrd Skynyrd. But before we get to those stories, anybody in between memorable?
The Kiss story is memorable because I can never believe they let me perform with them.
Okay, like, let's start from the beginning. What year was the Kiss story?
That was 75, so I'm probably skipping a lot of other stories. But that was really memorable for
okay,
me.
But 75, Rock and Roll All Night from the live album has been a hit.
Well, actually, when I went to the story, it was the night after they recovered. Recorded Alive, their big breakout live album.
Okay, so it wasn't released yet.
No, it wasn't released.
Okay, were you a Kiss fan?
Well, I was a really huge Kiss Idea fan. I had gone to London to cover David Essex in one of those many things.
Rocked On,
which was an amazing song. And I came back to New York. I had a layover because there was no nonstops to Detroit. And I went to some Marist forum, and Kiss was one of the speakers. They were on this little panel with Richard Robinson, Danny Fields, and Wayne County. It was about gender in rock and roll. And they all switched around their name tags, and they would answer every question with, "It's only rock and roll, but I like it because that Stone song had just come out." And I thought, this is hilarious. I can't believe they're not breaking character. This is really wonderful. We have to cover it. I get back to Cream, go, "Oh, I saw this band. Like, you know, they have a record out, and, you know, they're just like nightmares." And everybody said, "Oh, no, they're just like New York Doll clones. They're just trash. They're cartoons." And I go, no, we got to cover them. And I remember Ben Edmonds telling me, "Cover them. You cover them. You want to cover them, you write it." So I created this rock, like Kiss comic, a comic strip panel with outtakes from Dressed to Kill. And that was how we first got them in there. And I don't know, I just pressed hard to get Kiss in there because I just had this idea. Even though I didn't love the music, it was like an idea whose time had come. And it was just so comic book and so, I don't know, so death of art that I thought we could make fun of them, which we pretty much did.
Right. Although after you left, it seemed to be all Kiss and Cream magazine. Mm-hmm. But prior to going on stage with Kiss, what was your relationship with them? Or was that the very beginning?
When I met them at that panel, and then they would play Detroit all the time. And then I got this idea of doing a Kiss Comics, which it was Kiss Comics with a K, K-O-M-I-K. And I did that. So I went and talked to them then. And we got really friendly because, I don't know, there was just, we were all the same age. We were all coming up together. I think they were making like $100 a week and we were making $22.75. So we just had this camaraderie. Like I felt like Angie Dickinson in the Rat Pack with them, really.
So tell us the famous story.
About going on stage?
Yes.
There used to be a guy who worked there, Larry, who was Neil Bogart, Casablanca Records cousin.
He happened to write a good book. He died just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I can't forget his last
aneurysm.
Name.
Yeah, before that, Larry Harris. And he was always bringing bands over to Cream, and he was just a load of fun. And I called him up one day and I said, Connie Kramer and I have this idea, Barry's wife, because there was a story in Esquire Blair Sobel had done about being an Ikeette. So Connie and I one night working late were reading it, and she says, "Do you think you could do that?" And I go, "Oh yeah, I could do that." She goes, "With Kiss, right?" And I go, "Yeah, with Kiss." So I called up Larry Benjamin the next day and I said, "Could I go on stage with Kiss?" And he goes, "What?" And I go, "No, can I go on stage with Kiss?" And he said, "Yes, but you can't call them a glitter band." And I go, "Oh, no problem. I won't call them a glitter band. Okay." So they come to town maybe a week later, and I go to soundcheck to learn their moves because I'm going to go on stage with them, right? And when I meet the band members, who I know, not well, but I know, I say, "Yeah, I'm going to blah, blah, blah. I'm going to go on stage with you." And they think I'm going to cover the band. They don't know. No one's told them I'm going to go on stage with them. And they look at me like I'm crazy. So the next morning after they record their album, we go to Johnstown, Pennsylvania on a little prop plane. And there I am. They outfit me. Then they're like mother hens. Then they're into it. And we're going to all be in this together. And they're going to fix me up. And they take turns putting their makeup on. They argue like I'm looking too much like Gene Simmons because he's like putting his bat wings on me. And, you know, Ace Frehley is making fun of me because I don't know how to put makeup on because I never wore foundation. So, but it was great. I have to say it changed my life because I understood the addictive nature of what happens when someone's on stage and that surge of energy that you get from being on stage. I understood at that moment why people do what they do and why they can't give it up. And I think that story, not for the notoriety, but more for that actual recognition of why musicians do that, has like really served me for the rest of my life.
Okay, so how long did it take him to make you up?
Oh, like 25 minutes longer. It takes them a long time. Even today, like I just covered, well, last year I covered them in their End of the World tour. They've been in there for 2 hours. I mean, it is really an intense process of stages upon stages of making up.
And at what point do you go on stage?
Well, I'm thinking I'm doing the whole show in my innocence. So they go on stage. I try to go after them, all dressed up just like them, you know? And the road manager pulls me and goes, no, you got the last song. So I had to watch the whole show with the jitters. Like, I'm just shredding Kleenex. Then I'm nervous. Like, I'm all full of bravado. I'll do it, you know, when I think I'm going to go do the whole show. I don't know what I was thinking. So when Rock and Roll All Night comes on, they push me out there, give me this red guitar. I think it's a Fender. And Paul tells me, like, wear it low, really low. It looks sexier that way. And again, they're like mother hens watching me, like I'm their kid at a recital. And it's so funny. But I realized, I just made this realization the other day. I was thinking about this, that nobody in that crowd in Johnstown, Pennsylvania knew there was an extra member of KISS there. Like, I never heard about it. No one wrote it. It wasn't in the paper. It was like just some kind of big blooper. And the only way I ever knew about it is because I wrote about it later, you know, afterwards. But that realization just cracked me up, that it was like, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear, did it really fall? Did it? Maybe it was just all mock.
So what'd you do during the number you were on stage?
I actually had an open mic. I sang with them and I danced around. I danced behind Paul. And Paul told me later, he goes, I forgot you were there. All of a sudden I looked and it was like another me, like a big Minnie Mouse singing. So.
And of course, anybody who's seen KISS knows they wear these gigantic platforms. Did you have a pair of platform boots?
I did. I did anyway. So I just wore my own. I actually had the right stuff, except for the jewelry. I was definitely right in line with their fashion statement.
Okay, so you have the experience and you have the insight still continuing. You go back to write the story. Do you realize the impact the story will have both for readers who are fans of KISS and for you personally?
No, I just think it's another story. I was always about high concept stories. Like, I'd done other high concept stories before. So I just thought it was like the George Plimpton thing. Like, nobody would even notice. It would just be another story. How I knew it was a really big deal, and I swear it's some of the best things that ever happened to me, was the Braille Musicians Guide wanted to license it. And I thought, oh my God, blind kids will actually see what that's like. So to me, that's like, I don't know why that one just really touches my heart, but it did. Yeah, that's like the story that's just reverberated around the world. Like, you know, just I got to do it. So.
Okay, one thing that always went through my brain during that era, it had the line, the maiden-form bra, which, of course, was the line from the ad. But at that point in time, no one in the demo wore a maiden-form bra, right?
Right. That's so true. Well, it's because I grew up on, like, fashion magazines. It's like, do you remember the ad? Well, you wouldn't remember that, but girls would remember the ad was these women would wear bras, and they would wake up in these odd places, like at the symphony or in the office, and they'd be wearing, like, a pencil skirt, and they'd be wearing just a bra on the top.
So, I remember that. I had two sisters.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so I dreamt that I was on stage with KISS in my maiden form bra, which I wasn't wearing. But the fact it was like such a great hook.
It was great. Absolutely. So you're a Led Zeppelin fan from the beginning?
I am such a Led Zeppelin fan. When I worked at the Grandy Ballroom, I was a big Yardbirds fan. And one weekend I'm working there and this new band who no one ever heard of was Led Zeppelin. So no one was at the venue. Like, no one knew who they were, so no one showed up. By the second night, it was like wall-to-wall people. Like, word spread like wildfire. They were amazing. Like, they looked beautiful. They played. Like, it was just like sound just broke through. It's like that where mind meets body. It was a transformative experience for me. And then when they came back, I remember taking my break during their set and getting on stage with them so I could hear them better. And all of a sudden, I saw this picture of me, like I've got like my elbows on Jimmy Page's amp, and I'm just like, you know, like angelically looking, like watching his every mood. So yeah, they were like my band.
And what's your favorite Zeppelin album?
Physical Graffiti.
I go back and forth between Physical Graffiti and the first.
Yeah.
Physical Graffiti, if no other reason, has got 10 years gone, which I can't get enough of.
I know. Well, I love the first one because I think that bass, that bubbling bass, like it's being played underwater.
Right.
Unbelievable. Even today, it's still unbelievable to me. And they were just so mysterious.
Okay, so how do you end up interviewing them?
The first time I interview them, I just think that it was one of those things that nobody else wanted to do it, as odd as that is. And they're playing Detroit, and I interview them just backstage at Olympia where they were playing. And it was no big deal. It was just, you know, it was just a regular rock interview. I wasn't on the road with them. And then later on, I go on the road with them for, I forgot what album it was, but there was one they were holed up in the Plaza Hotel for like weeks upon weeks. And I went for like probably 4 days. So we'd fly out to various cities and we'd come back. And that was like, again, not a big deal. Like in terms of it being bigger than life, yes. But it wasn't until my third time where it got really odd. It was one of those almost famous moments where Jimmy Page didn't want to do the interview, even though it was for a cover story. So I had to dog him for 5 days, like ask, could I have an interview? And on the last day before I was going to go home, they finally granted it to me, but only in the provision that I couldn't speak directly to him. I had to speak through an interpreter. So I had to ask the questions to the publicist and she would translate them to him. And it was like being in a foreign film and with subtitles and watching it because it was so bizarre because we all spoke English, but I'd have to ask him, he would answer her, and she would answer me. So this went on for like a half an hour. It was so unnerving, but at some point I got this like little like thought balloon, like, oh man, I can make this funny. You know, I can like do a thought balloon thing, like what's really going through my head. But it was so unnerving. I mean, I don't know how I pulled out of that one, but it was, you know, once you get, it's the old, you get lemons, you make lemonade. I really made lemonade on that one.
Okay. You're in this uptight situation. Do you whip out your curveball question or do you say, I don't want to screw things up?
No, you don't. I really, although I have to say that I did because it was during the tour where the tour doctor confronted Jimmy Page about someone stealing the Quaaludes that were the tour doctor carried. And I had the audacity to ask him if he actually stole the Quaaludes. So, and he was just indignant. And the crazy part is, part two of the story, in 2006, Q Magazine hired me to do my recollections on Led Zeppelin tours. So I wrote about that whole tour. And a friend of mine, Brad Tulinski, who was the editor of Guitar World, was friends with Jimmy Page. And one day he calls me and said, there's somebody here who wants to talk to you. And he puts Jimmy Page on the phone and he goes, Jan, I stole the Quaaludes. I lied.
That's funny.
That was great. I had no idea he was going to do that. I was like one of those things, yeah, sure. Sure, it's Jimmy Page. But it was great.
Hi there. I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, now, having met a lot of these rock stars, and I've met them myself, they very rarely live up to the image in your head. So that begs the question, who did and who didn't?
I'd say Ronnie Van Zant did. He was like a prophet. He was like tapped into something that the rest of us just don't hear. You know, it was like he knew where he was going, and the sad part was he knew when he was leaving. And I think, talk about unnerving, when I did a story on him, and I was ill-prepared. It was Lester Bangs' birthday, and he decided he didn't want to do the story because it was his birthday. And he said, Jan, you go do the story. Here's the questions, and just shove me out of the nest. Really, I just did that. But during the course of the interview, and it was really long, I interviewed all of them, Ronnie and I just sat and talked, and he said, you know, I have Janis Joplin disease. I don't think I'm going to be here long. In fact, I doubt I'll see 30. This was about a month before his 29th birthday. And, you know, it was one of those things that I don't know why. I might have left out Rick Wakeman's towel, but I put in that Ronnie Van Zant said he was never going to see 30. And then I remember being in Los Angeles reviewing some concert and hearing that their plane had gone down and there were some survivors, and I immediately knew it wasn't him. You know, it was like there was a presence of something like surreal, metaphysical. Like, I think the best musicians get their information from someplace that we'll never know. And I think he was one of them. I think he was like the one who had the greatest impact on me.
Just assume, although we can't, if he had not passed away, would he still have had the greatest impact?
I don't know that, because I think it was the fact that he shared that with me. That's a really great question. He shared that moment with me, and I was somehow a part of it. I think that's what the impact was. Other people, you know, I remember people who are nice to little people. You know, I love, like, Kirk Hammett from Metallica is always great and personalizes every interview and makes you feel like a human. I think when a rock star makes you feel like we're, again, back to that Cream ethos, that we're all the same and they remember you. Although your friend and my friend, Vicky Strait, told me a secret and I've got to stop now or she'll kill me. Never mind.
You know Vicky through the Metallica Club, or do you know her previously at Columbia?
I know her because she's from Royal Oak, Michigan, the next town over from where I grew up. And later,
okay,
Village.
We'll talk this off mic. But yeah. In any event, this brings us to Lester Bangs. I mean, on my end, the most famous thing with Lester Bangs, he wrote a review for Rolling Stone of Alice Cooper's Killer. And it was boxed out, and it was so over the top. This was in the days of the Great White Wonder and hoaxes, that I bought the album just to see if it was a hoax or not.
Oh,
of course,
God.
You drop the needle. It was under my wheels, and it was, of course, incredible. So you follow the guy. Then he's playing on stage with the typewriter, et cetera. Then they have he dies. They have the compilation book. So people like you and me know who these guys
are.
His guys. Then Cameron makes the movie, turns him into a folk hero who won't be forgotten.
Yeah.
What was your experience of Lester Bangs?
You know, one of the greatest people I've ever met, too. Great impact on me had he even lived. In fact, I have a reoccurring dream about every 2 years where he says to me, Jan, I'm not dead, I'm just in Florida. So I can't tell you how odd that is for me. But he was really he would call like subscribers up or people who'd write him letters. We would, because we worked so late, we would all like get on the phone. He would call people who wrote him and give them encouragement. I mean, he was every young writer's best friend. He was certainly mine. I mean, he really helped me with a lot of things. He was driven in a way that you hardly ever see. When I say that people think that stories come out of your fingers, not your brain, they seem to come out of his fingers. It was like, I don't want to belabor this like people know where they're going to go, but it was like he was racing the devil. Like he almost felt like he didn't have all the time that he wanted, because he would sit down and just write the most beautifully constructed, well thought out pieces. It was a marvel, and actually gave me a phobia for a long time, because I wondered why I didn't write that fast. You know, he was a guy who would stir the shit. I mean, all you had to do is go to one of those Lou Reed confabs. Every time he interviewed Lou Reed, he would always bring a posse, and I was there a couple of times, and he would just goad writers, I mean, rock stars, into like saying things that they might not. Like he called them a little insect, or asked them about his wife, girlfriend, Rachel, who was like omnisexual. I never figured that one out, but he would insult them to their face. And it was like, it was a sight to be behold. It was also really embarrassing, but I can't say he did it in good fun. I think he just did it because he wanted a reaction, because he knew it was a better story. He could be brutal and he could be the kindest man in the world. There was no middle speed with Lester. It was either fast or slow.
And what do you think about his depiction in Almost Famous?
Well, having had a little to do with that, Cameron hired me and Jim DeRogatis to do little treatments. So it was so accurate. I'm going to say that Cameron was such a genius in that character for two reasons. They would call me from the set all the time and go, what kind of pizza did he really eat? Or whatever, did the barbecue really come from there? So he was just a slave to the detail, and it comes across. But the other thing which was so strange is casting Philip Seymour Hoffman, because I interviewed him for Mojo and I was sitting across from him and I felt like there was Lester's ghost. He would even, when he talked, he ate and he would talk with his mouth full, something Lester always did. I felt like he was a mediumistic actor anyway, but I felt like I was in the presence of Lester. I can't think that anyone was any better than that, like in that choice.
Oh, going back to Almost Famous, you know, the scenes in the Riot House, which is no longer called a Hyatt, they changed the branding. Those of us who followed that from the late 60s on, especially a lot of the British musicians, these were dark characters doing dark things, dripping wax on people. What was your insight into the dark side of these musicians?
Well, you know, it was always fascinating how they got that way. I mean, the thing is that they would actually talk about it if you had the guts to ask somebody about it. Maybe not Jimmy Page, who was the purveyor of most of that, you know. But I don't know. I mean, it was like, how did they get away with that? I honestly have to say I didn't ever get involved in anything that like nefarious or witness to it, because I don't know, maybe this is the part about not going for the sleaze part of it. I was always more ironic, psychological, like satiric writer. So I usually didn't see any of the whoremonging, you know. I do remember like when I was on tour with Led Zeppelin, I mean, Jimmy Page dressing up just like this most beautiful boy there and having his arms slung around, you know, around his back. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm a little young and I'm Midwestern and this is the first time I've seen that. So it kind of jolted me. So, you know, I wasn't privy to all of that stuff. I'm not really sure who it was, except for who's Stanley Booth, who wrote the really great book on the Rolling Stones. I mean, right. not many people. You had to hang with them. You had to have the same kind of habits, have the same kind of cool, have the same kind of elan. Nick Kent, he did with Iggy and with like I think probably with Zeppelin, with Iggy definitely.
Do you think you're cool?
I do think I'm cool.
Okay, is it something you always knew?
It was something I always knew. But did I cultivate it? Yeah, maybe. I think it was just like I kind of grew up being fully formed. Like I always knew what I wanted, and it's that never let them see you sweat kind of thing.
Okay, well, so continue.
No, so others may disagree. You know, I don't have my distractors.
Okay. So what do your parents do for a living when you're growing up?
My dad worked at Ford. He was a design engineer, and my mom was a dancer who hung up her shoes by the time, you know, my sister and I came along.
And how many generations has your family been in America?
My parents were both second generation. Their parents were born in the old country, as they so quaintly say.
How'd your parents meet?
They met in a bar in Detroit.
And did they remain married during their lifetimes?
They did.
Okay. And how many siblings do you have?
I just have one sister who's a photographer.
And she's older or younger?
She's younger.
By how many years?
By 7.
That's a long time. What was going on there?
Well, at least something. Actually, my mom was afraid of the pain of childbirth, so she vowed never to have another child until they introduced drugs into the birthing process. So my sister is like a drug baby.
Okay, so you go to school. Are you like popular? Do you have friends? Or what kind of kid are you?
I'm the second tallest kid in elementary school. So I either had a really good bird's eye view, or I was a really like, I was a little bit of an outcast, but not really. Like I had like my subgenre of people. So, you know, I was really like Sporty Spice. I was super athletic. I used to compete in track. So, you know, I was pretty normal, but I think the hardest thing was my name was so unpronounceable that I definitely had a complex. I remember a letter to Cream in later years, and my favorite letter is someone said, "Tell Jan Uhelski to get an American name." And I've always loved that.
That's a good sense of humor, as good as the writers for Cream. Did you have that sense of humor before you went to the magazine?
Or
Okay.
Yeah.
And Dave Marsh, who has a reputation, anybody who's dealt with him has an edge. What was your experience working with him?
He was always a kindly older brother, and not that much older, but you know, he was really impish with me. Like we would go on, like when the Michigan State Fair would come, he would go on rides with me. Like we could be kids together. I think we and Robbie Krueger were the youngest people on the staff. So we just brought out the kid in each other. He was always amazing to me. For a long time, I felt like his apologist, and then I decided, why bother? You know, he can do it himself. But I've always seen a really good side of him.
Okay, since we have this movie, which goes back to then, where are all these people today, and do you continue to have contact with them?
I do. Everybody you see who's on the staff or who's still alive, absolutely. And the dead ones, yeah. Obviously, they come in dreams. But yeah, I keep in touch. There was something about the fraternity of being in Cream in the beginning, at the inception of something really amazing and going through it. It's like almost like going to high school with people together or going through a war. Like we experienced things together that you didn't experience in normal day. It was really like heightened reality there.
And what happened to them job-wise?
Well, most people stayed, either went into advertising, like Robert Duncan owned an ad agency, Eric Genheimer. Everybody actually got really good jobs. It was a good step up. I mean, Susan Whitehall became the pop music critic at the Detroit News. Lester, I don't know, Lester, he had to do that vagabond, go to New York and be a New York writer thing, you know? You know, I'm not really sure what went wrong. I'm not sure what twist he took. I mean, he was always a heavy drinker, and we definitely consumed codeine because we thought it would be a performance enhancer in terms of our writing. But, you know, I never thought of him as that excessive. I mean, maybe I'm naive about that, but I didn't see that. I think everybody really got good jobs afterwards.
Okay, just staying with Lester, as an outsider and reading the publicity, it was the punk era where theoretically anybody could get on stage.
Yeah.
It seemed from a distance that he wanted to be on stage a star, not only a writer. Was that your experience, or would you say that's untrue?
You know, I think that happened after I left. Like, I left in 1976 in March, and he left in December of 76. And then he started, you know, I think the Radio Birdman happened maybe the next couple of years. I honestly thought when he got on stage with Peter Wolf and Jay Giles, that was a fluke. That was just another story, one of our high concept stories. So I was actually surprised because he didn't have a tremendous voice, you know, but he had that chutzpah. I remember the whole thing, like we was in a band with Mickey Joy Ramone's brother also, and they described it, both the Mickey and Joey described it as kind of like Lester was like that movie where it's not Bill Murray, the What About Bob, where the guy comes up and shows up with the shrinks. That's how Lester was, because their stepfather was his shrink. So I don't know. I honestly was surprised when he did it.
Okay, so how did you decide to leave Cream?
This is really personal, but Charlie Arringer slept with my best friend, Peggy Carlson, one of the t-shirt girls. And I thought, I'm out of here. It was like one of those things. It was a watershed moment. And my whole life spun on that moment.
Okay. How did you find out?
He told me.
Why?
Because I told them that she wanted him to fix her up with his assistant. And he told me, no, she's more interested in me. And I go, oh no, she's my best friend. Honestly, my whole life collapsed on that moment. And I started making other plans.
Just what went through your head when he told you that?
It was like a hot knife, you know?
To go a little bit deeper, was this a one-time event or was he having a full-blown affair with
no,
her?
No, I think it was a one-time event, but it just really caught me, you know? I think I was so unaware of it actually, even to this day, I don't know. I think it was just a one-time event. And of course, I've forgiven them all and we're all like not close, but, you know, amends have been made. But honestly, I have to say that it was the small moment that actually informed the whole rest of my life.
Okay, walk us through that quickly.
Oh, then I decided I was going to probably go get another job. I remember Barry Kramer saying to me, well, you better make this work, because if I have to fire somebody, I'm going to fire you, because Charlie's been with me since day one. He is the art director, and you're one of many editors. So I pretty much went through the motions for the next couple of years until I finally left.
So it took a couple of years.
Oh, yeah. I just started planning. I'm a planner. Can't you see that? That's kind of the through line.
Okay. So everybody knew.
Barry knew. I didn't tell anybody else.
Okay. So for these couple of years, needless to say, you're not his girlfriend anymore, right?
I'm just faking it. I'm like phoning it in.
Okay, so then how do you ultimately decide to make the break, and how does that happen?
I actually met somebody else, you know, because I didn't feel all that monogamous anymore. So I met a photographer at a barbecue at the Capricorn Barbecue.
And wow.
Yeah.
So wait, just let's go back. All these events, they would say, hey, do you want to come? We're going to pay.
Yeah.
How often did you go?
Mm. Well, I'd say I went on the road 1 week a year, 1 week, 1 week a month. Like every time you did a story, you went on the road and they would like thing whip you, you know, like they would like say, I remember back to the London trip. I remember them saying, the record company would say, well, if you need anything, it's right before Christmas. If you need anything, just go get a few things from the gift shop. So it was like payola, yet insidious, subtle payola.
Okay, but being on the road, forget being in one town, but being on the road on a bus, even in a plane, it takes a strong constitution to be on the road for a week. You don't get much sleep, etc. I mean, what's your viewpoint about going on the road? Been there, done that, don't want to do it again?
No, I think that you get the best stories because you get people in the act of being themselves. So you see so much more, just like the Steve Miller thing. You see the small motions, the how someone interacts with somebody else, how they act in any situation, but you don't see that when you're sitting across from somebody in a record company office. Like given the choice, I will always go. Now you don't go on the road, you go to somebody's house. Like now I'll go to because most of the stories I do for Uncut Magazine, they're in-home visits. Like I show up at somebody's house with, you know, my digital recorder and my camera, and I do the story. So I pick up the clues of a person. Well, on the road, it's like it's stretched out. You're picking up clues with somebody for like a week or 3 days or 4 days or however long it was. But it was some time, and you get these sit-down sessions with them, or you'd go do things with them, like go see a jazz band or do this or that. Like the Allman Brothers was like that.
So you go to the Capricorn picnic, you meet this other guy. How do you finally quit?
He asked me to marry him, and I moved to L.A.
And where he was?
Where he was, and it didn't work out.
How long did it take not to work out?
5 days.
5 days?
Five days.
How much contact had you had him before you moved out, had with him before you moved out?
A lot more than you would think, but I would come to that conclusion after 5 days.
What was the deal breaker?
He had done EST. Remember EST, that self-realization kind of program that people did in the 70s, Warren Earhart.
Right.
And he was going to go back for a seminar while I was there, my first few days when I was there. And when he came back from the seminar, he said he didn't feel like he had thoroughly ended it with his ex-girlfriend and maybe I should move out. So it was kind of not my decision, but I refused to tell anybody because I had quit the best job in the world to move to L.A.
And did you have a job in L.A.?
No. I started freelancing for Playgirl magazine. I don't know if you remember that magazine.
Of course. Burt Reynolds was centerfold.
That's the one. So I worked for them a little bit. And then I ultimately got hired at Record World. And that was, which led to the next chapters of my life. So I became the columnist at Record World, like shortly after that. I just said I wasn't going home. I sent all my furniture with me. Like everything I owned was with me in L.A.
And did you have enough money to exist?
Well, when my grandmother died, she gave me a dream book. She said, go to the track with the dream book because everything you dream has a number, and bet those, and $500. So, I actually made money, you know, and I supported myself. And then I got the job at Record World, and then, you know, things just picked up.
Okay, so then you get married, you have your daughter. What's your daughter up to today?
She is an ad copywriter, and she owns a candle company where she makes candles, like metaphysical candles based on the tarot.
And where does she live?
She lives in New York.
Okay. And you have her. She grows up. How do you go back to college? How do you decide to get back into the writing game?
When I graduated from college, I went to work for the Democratic Party, and I worked for a National Women's Political Caucus. And it's women trying to get other women elected. But the crazy part about it was a little mean spirit. It was woman on woman crime. And it was so, like, I was so shocked that there was not that camaraderie, like we're in this together, which I like. That's my favorite thing. We're collaborative with a lot of people towards one goal. And it wasn't that. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? So I started, I started freelancing. I thought, well, I'm not going to be, I was going to go to graduate school to go get a teaching degree to teach history. And I thought, no, that doesn't really appeal to me. So I started freelancing, and I started getting hired a lot for writing about music. So I just went down that path. It just opened up again. I mean, it was pretty much, I just re-entered my life where I left it.
Okay. Needless to say, we grew up in an era where music drove the culture.
Yeah.
What do you think about today's scene and today's music vis-a-vis what it was?
Well, I feel like they don't seek their, I don't know, I got my identity from music. I mean, somehow in the lyrics, there was prophecy. It was encoded. It was a message that we all got, you know? And if you like the Stones, you were a certain kind of person. And if you like the Beatles, you were another kind. Like, it defined who we were, everything. Now, people don't need that sense of identification. It's not so cut and dry. It's not a world of straights and heads, as that, you know, that term used to be too. So I think that there's other ways that people pick up who they are, their persona. And if there's anything, I mean, people are more gamers, you know, and music has just fallen out. It's kind of background music. And I think it's really a disservice because I still think that somehow musicians are tapped in and they hear things that the rest of us don't. They just get some kind of message, some kind of enlightenment, some kind of way to live. And maybe I'm putting too much on a musician, but I've found out a lot of things that I know I find just by probing a musician's brain. I mean, I don't know. You interview musicians. I mean,
I find that, you know, you talk about being in a club and being different. The only people I tend to be able to relate to are musicians. They have the same attitude.
Yeah.
They're outsiders. They can laugh at life. They're going to go, whereas everybody else, you know, is following the buck and checking off the boxes, whatever, which is just not who I am.
Right.
And I'm going to ask you a very standard question, but you have so much experience, I think people want to know. You've been to so many concerts. What are the handful of best concerts you ever saw?
Prince at Radio City back in the 80s, maybe 81. That was probably number one. The Stone Roses, actually, at the Fillmore, when they came back for their Second Coming album, that was transformative. Led Zeppelin, the second time I saw them in 1969. The Beatles in 1966, even though I couldn't hear them, it was like one of those life-changing. And Conor Oberst, when he was Bright Eyes around 2004, that one just really spoke to my core. There's something, again, something in his voice, something in his expression, something in that stream of consciousness words. It's almost like deciphering cave dwelling. Like, I feel like, again, he's tapped into something, and I relate to that. But I always think that art's a mirror. Like, the bands you like, the artists you like, they reflect something of yourself. And you see that in them. And obviously something I see in myself, I see in him. Maybe not Led Zeppelin. That's just pure, like, bombast. I don't know. I think I have, like, an incomplete theory about that. But those are my five favorites.
Okay, at the time, you know, the Stone Roses only had one album. They were legends in the UK.
Yeah.
Really didn't have impact in the US. Why was the show so great?
You know, I came to them late. I missed them the first time around, and it was really an assignment. Like, I had to cover it for, I was working for a news magazine, Addicted to Noise, that I did back in the early 90s with Michael Goldberg, one of the first online music magazines. And it was one of those things which always works for me. Like, he said, just go cover these guys. So I started writing the news about them, and then I did an interview with them. And when they came out for that second tour after that second album on Elektra, I don't know, there was just magic. There's just something in that kind of, like, shoegazer tonality. It's just really like sound. Like, Bruce Slick said that God is energy, and you know, music is vibration, and that's where the holy lives. And there was something about that Stone Roses concert that I saw at the Fillmore, not technically wonderful. Ian Brown's voice was flat, but there was just something in that whole experience of that blast of sound, that way it goes into your body and the visceral reaction to it. They just strike a chord with me, and that's really what it is.
Did you keep the records in the ephemera?
Yes. No, not any of it. I had the Stone Roses stuff. I have the gold, Fool's Gold album. But no, I gave everything away. I even gave my last cream t-shirt to Joey Ramone. Like, no, nothing.
Well, that makes a story. That's worth. So why did you, I mean, to get the records for free, that was one reason you became a rock critic.
Right.
Okay. So you gave them away later in life or during the era?
No, you know, I could get everything back. Like, I always was traveling light. Like, when I moved to California, I was thinking about this because my daughter is moving to LA, and I was thinking about how much stuff I put on that Mayflower truck, and did I take my records? Yeah, just a select few. I found them when my father died. I found the rest of them, and I just sold them in like an estate sale. But, you know, the other fact was they weren't in good shape. My parents, living in Michigan, they would have annual floods, so they weren't in great shape. But I just think I was always going to be able and pick up that stuff again. I think it was always going to go on forever. I said that in the Cream documentary. I'm not sure it made it into the film, but they asked me if I kept anything. I said, no, I didn't keep anything. I really thought it would go on forever and I could go get my Cream t-shirts later, you know?
Okay. If you had to do it all over again, same path?
Same path. You?
Well, that, you know, this is about you. Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say I don't have any regrets, but there are choices I made that I question. Okay. In terms of dedicating myself to rock and roll, not that it was consciously that, you know, it's kind of like Godfather 3. You know, you try to leave, it just pulls you back in.
Oh, yeah.
And so what did we learn in all this, you know, this journey of decades?
I think that I mean, it's a thing that I keep going back to, that there's something holy in the sound. It's like the tribe speaks to each other through music. And I like to be part of the tribe. I mean, I really did grow up in that hippie era, and I feel completely dedicated to preserving that group think, that we're in it together and we can make this a better way. And I got those messages in the music. Like, I remember this Lester quote. It's something like he listened to rock bands obsessively because in some flashlight moment he saw a hope of a better world, a better society. He saw prophecy in that. And that quote always got me, because that was it. It's like I saw some vision that I wanted to be. Did I want to date rock stars? No. Did I want to be them? No. I just wanted to explain them to myself and then explain them to other people. It was just fascinating to me.
Well, needless to say, the ethos has changed. When we were growing up, if there were any Republicans, you literally knew who they were and you could point them out. Okay. And certainly remember after Kent State, we had Ohio. We also remember listening to the radio. The radio gave you everything, gave you the music, gave you the news, whatever. But it doesn't seem to be that way. This, just going to the ultimate question, is there hope? You seem to be an optimistic person in a nation full of turmoil. Is there hope, and what role does music have to play in that?
You know, I think it's more like artists, or maybe actors, or any kind of artists. You know, it's like if you can make enough of a statement in people who follow you, which that's what it is, you know, that they will follow you anywhere kind of thing. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's always room for the truth. And, you know, sometimes it's listened to and sometimes it's not. Do I feel pessimistic about the future? I still feel like it's going to readjust. Things get so bad that the pendulum has to swing the other way. So I don't know. Is there hope for music? I want to say yes, but not in the part. It doesn't occupy the same place in the culture, and it may never again.
Well, you've certainly laid down some truth and insight here. Jan, this has been wonderful. Thanks so much for sharing your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.
Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
Even working with you from Carrie Hills and Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school, like, okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Pitbull.
I think that education is the real revolution, because as much as we speak about all the problems that there is in society and the world today, my mother's always told me, son, don't worry, the world's always been coming to an end. Don't let it scare you out of living.
Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.